Ready to form Voltron. Activate interlocks. Dinotherms connected. Impracel up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, your host for Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. And as we get down to the end of April, today's podcast could be considered the 2.5 or even the third part to the Robotech Voltron crossover comic review. After our last podcast, Tommy Yoon informed me that the other writer of the Robotech Voltron crossover comics, Bill Spangler, lives in my own hometown. So, obviously, we had to complete the trifecta for Robotech Voltron, and we had to talk to Bill Spangler. But before I bring Bill on the podcast, we have to talk about the Voltron item that went up for sale on ThinkGeek on April 1st. As you all know, ThinkGeek has a habit of bringing out April Fool's items, obviously, that aren't real products, but we had our hopes that the Voltron Cat Condo was going to be a real product. Obviously, we can't expect that they're actually going to make this and sell it as a product, especially at the $189 price point that they were selling it for. But here's a description of the product. Four blazing kitties. From days of long ago, from uncharted regions of the universe, comes a legend. The legend of Voltron, Defender of the Universe. A mighty cat condo, loved by good, feared by evil. As Voltron's legend grew, peace settled across the galaxy. On planet Earth, a galaxy alliance was formed. Together with the good pets of the solar system, they maintained peace throughout the universe. Until a new horrible menace threatened the galaxy. Stale kibble. Voltron was needed once more. This is the story of the super force of space explorers, specially trained and sent by the Alliance to sleep and play and, well, sleep some more within Voltron, Defender of the Universe. Alright, so it was cool that Voltron got front and center on ThinkGeek on April Fool's Day, but as we all know, this is not probably going to become a product. But now that everybody's got an idea, if you decide that you want to make one of these yourself and you end up doing it, please send us a picture. We would appreciate that. And, maybe someday there will be a real Voltron product developed from ThinkGeek. So thank you, ThinkGeek, for thinking about Voltron. And we'll get back to our podcast. And we want to welcome the writer of the third, fourth, and fifth issues of the Voltron Robotech Comics crossover series, as well as the end of issue 2. Welcome, Bill Spangler.
I want to thank you, Bill, for joining me here on the podcast. It was quite a surprise and quite a shock when Tommy Yoon told me that you were living in the same town that I live in. So, and all this time, for the past, 12 years you said you've lived here, right?
About 10 years, yeah.
Oh, 10 years, yeah. Okay. Well, I've lived here for about 13,
right.
And I had no idea that one of the writers of the Robotech comics was sitting here right in my hometown.
Yeah, we moved here in 2004, my wife and I, we like it very much. Quakertown is great because it has both kind of small town stuff and arts-oriented stuff, and all it really needs is a big box bookstore. But
I agree. We have the friendly bookstore.
Yeah, yeah, and lying around, which is good. But yeah,
right. We've been sitting in this same hometown, and we could have caught up a long time ago, and I would have known then, to bring you obviously into this podcast a lot sooner.
Did you know that there's professional science fiction writer in the area, a guy named Alexei Panshin?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, he's not as active as he used to be, but he wrote three or four novels and a bunch of short stories, including a novel called Rite of Passage, which I believe won an award.
Wow.
In I don't know how much you know about prose science fiction fandom, but there are two basic awards. There's the Hugo Awards, which is voted on by the fans, and the Nebulas, which are voted on by the writers. And I think he won the Nebula for Rite of Passage. He still runs a website and posts stuff. I think he's going to start reprinting some of his fiction. But he was active for a while. He's not quite as active as he used to be. But I've only met him face-to-face once or twice myself since moving up here.
Okay, did you actually start in the science fiction genre, or did you start in another type of genre?
Well, I've always read science fiction, and I've always written science fiction. My degree is actually in journalism. I've worked for a bunch of small newspapers all over the state.
You got your degree at Penn State,
right? Yeah,
I did too.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
We're yeah. both Penn State alumni. So I got another... mine in 1990.
It was also 74, you know, and I had always written fiction while I was doing this, you know, mostly for my own amusement. I had, you know, vague plans for stuff in the future. What happened was in the mid to late 1980s, there was a boom in independent comics. This is when the direct sales shops boomed, and okay. lots of people were starting companies to appeal to the direct sales shops that would just go into the direct sales shops.
Okay,
I answered an ad in a magazine called Comic Buyer's Guide. A company called Eternity was looking for proposals for comics. I had actually figured at the time, well, I'm not going to get in, but at least maybe I could start a conversation with these guys and get a relationship going that I might be able to get in with something else.
Okay.
And turns out what I sent them, they liked. It was a character I called Bloodwing. My elevator pitch description of Bloodwing is The Shadow meets Blade Runner.
Okay. Were there replicants like in Blade Runner? Or?
Yeah, actually there were. I called them the Jennies, which were short for genetiform, artificially created beings of one form or another.
Cool.
Yeah. And Tom Mason and Chris Ulm and Dave Ulbrich were the people in charge at Eternity at that point, and they bought Bloodwing. We did 8 issues of Bloodwing. We did another 4 issues of a thing I called The Argonauts, which actually has nothing to do with Jason. But at the time, I called it The Argonauts.
Okay.
It was my attempt to do sort of a modern Doc Savage type, Buckaroo Banzai type pulp team. It got a lot of good response, but it only went 4 issues. But as time wore on, you know, and Eternity branched out into different things. They bought the Robotech license from Kimiko.
Really?
Yeah. And when that was announced, what they had announced first off was that they were just going to adapt the Sentinels.
Okay.
And when they announced that, I called in saying, you know, so have you chosen a writer for the Sentinels? As it turns out, they had. But Chris Ulm said, why don't you do a proposal for something that's mentioned in the Sentinels, a thing called the Malcontent Uprisings, which was an event that took place between the end of the first cycle and the Sentinels. It was sort of an additional round of the Zentradi War, but it was all on Earth.
Okay.
So I said, yeah, sure, absolutely. I worked up a proposal for that because Harmony Gold wasn't familiar with me at that point. They wanted to see me write some dialogue pages in addition to the proposal. But once I did that, they were very happy to go on ahead with the Malcontent Uprisings. I've done a half dozen different series, a total of 80 different issues. I counted them up before coming here today.
Wow.
Malcontent Uprisings, one called Cyber Pirates, one called Return to Macross, one called Invid War, Robotech Voltron, one called Mech Angel, and one called Robotech Warriors, which was actually an attempt to kind of do a Zentradi solo book. But like I say, it was a total of 80 issues. So when somebody recognizes my name, it's usually in connection with the Robotech stuff.
Okay. All right. Well, is there things that you were doing in addition to the Robotech comic books that we might be able to see in publication?
Well, one thing for sure. One thing I did for Eternity during this period was a graphic novel adaptation of H.G. Wells' Time Machine. And with a British artist named John Ross. That book has just been reprinted by a little company called Pulp 2.0 Press. Yeah, I would definitely like to plug that. Yeah.
Okay. So that's just into reprints now. Yes. Yeah. It's an adaptation of H.G. Wells' Time Machine.
Right, right.
It's written by you.
Right.
And the artist's name was?
John Ross.
John Ross.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He's overseas. I think one of the main things he does these days is he draws Doctor Who comics for a British magazine that does Doctor Who material for a slightly younger audience than what we mostly see around here.
Okay.
But that's one thing he does for sure. And Eternity matched us up. We worked together on that. We worked together on a two-parter of The Argonauts that I did later for another publisher. I've sold some short stories. I've sold a couple of short stories. I've sold a lot of nonfiction. I've written reviews and articles for various magazines. Nothing terribly recent there, but that's the sort of thing I've been doing.
Didn't I see that you just wrote a couple of April Fool's articles?
Well, those were a number of years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, those were a number of years ago. I like writing humor. Those were a number of years ago. I may still have the clipping somewhere, but I wouldn't count on it necessarily.
So what do you think of the comic book shop that was at the Q Mart?
Oh, generally, I liked it. I had a nice relationship with Tony.
You did?
Yeah.
Well,
the gentleman there. I think the gentleman who runs it now is focusing mostly on running magic tournaments and that.
Right.
I haven't talked to him that much, but yeah.
Right. I kind of liked it better before they had the change in ownership.
Yeah.
And, they had a lot more stuff,
yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah, I don't think he's bought a new comic since he's taken it over.
Oh, okay. I liked kind of going there with my son and just checking out the comics. At one point I was picking up regularly the Charmed series. I liked the Charmed series from when it was on TV. And then they followed up with the comic book series. And then I was obviously, every time Dynamite came out with a new Voltron comic, I was jumping in there with my son.
Right.
And we picked up all of them up, including the Robotech Voltron ones. We went through, pretty much all of the issues with Tommy and Elmer. And I was wondering if we might be able to walk back through what we want to... The fans to understand, obviously, is that in the first issue, it's just Tommy as the writer.
Right.
In the second issue, it says Tommy Yoon with Bill Spangler.
Right.
And then in the last three issues, it's Bill Spangler with Tommy Yoon.
Right.
So what was that
part? How did that evolve? Okay.
Yeah, what was that part of that second issue that you got involved with?
Okay. Like Tommy mentioned in the first part, my first Robotech comics there came out in 1990. Tommy contacted me in 2004 or so just to introduce himself. I wasn't really doing any Robotech comics right then, but he just contacted me to introduce himself. And we talked on and off about doing various things. I would write an outline. I would write a couple of pages of text. We would talk about it. And then I heard that the Robotech Voltron crossover was coming. I was interested in it too, and not as a writer though, just more as a fan. But Tommy came to me and said that he had a lot on his plate right now, and he wanted to know if I could script the last three issues. So of course I was very interested in that. The story, the plot had been worked out pretty thoroughly at that point, but I came in to. I did a lot of the scripting for the last three issues. The reason why it says with Bill Spangler in issue two is that the last two pages on issue two, I actually wrote for issue three. Mm-hmm. And as Tommy was assembling things, he thought they went better at the end of issue two. And so we moved them forward, and he very graciously gave me a credit for it.
Okay. So that's good. And then you were full-blown into 3, 4, and 5.
Then. Right, right.
All right. What was your idea going into this about how you were going to take what had already been done by Tommy and then sort of bring it into a wrap up by the end of issue 5. How did you work that all out?
Well, I went in with a couple of goals in mind, I guess. One was the pure fanboy goal of, okay, I want to see Voltron mix it up with a Veritech.
Okay.
As it turns out, though, the plot really didn't allow that. The closest I could get was Colonel Edwards Veritech fighting Keith in issue 4. But that was just the fanboy idea of setting the mecha from the two universes against each other.
Okay. All right. So from what we had heard from Tommy and Elmer, it was that Colonel Edwards had this, you know, personality where he would selfishly do things on his own.
Right.
Even though it appeared that he might be friendly with, you know, somebody, he'll turn on them.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
That was certainly my understanding of the character, too.
Okay.
The other things I wanted to try to do was to, once in a while, try to have the two universes kind of interact in ways you don't expect. Unfortunately, the space messed us up. There wasn't time to develop anything properly. I don't know how familiar you are with Robotech, but one of the subplots in Macross is how Min-May's singing voice tames the Zentradi.
I've heard about that, but I've never, you know, read about it.
Yeah, that, you know, that's one of the subplots in that section, and I was playing with the idea that maybe her voice would have some effect on a Robeast too, but unfortunately there just wasn't the space to orchestrate that and develop it properly.
Okay.
But you know, I was looking for that sort of interaction. One of the things I could at least suggest in issue 3 is a scene where Max meets the Lion Force crew and talks to them, and that's the sort of thing I was looking to do, you know, doing sort of embellishments like that.
So it was Ben and Max that first saw Black Lion,
right,
and that was that part of your thing, or was that
no, that was Tommy.
That was Tommy. Okay. Yeah. All right, so that had already been introduced to you,
right?
All right, was there anything that you had suggested that they actually accepted that you weren't sure whether they were going to accept it or not?
Well, a couple of things. One thing, we'll want to talk about this in more detail, is the 2-page spread at the end of issue 5, when we see all the kind of parallel universe versions of the Voltrons and how Voltron and Robotech might interact. That was basically my idea.
Wow, that was pretty powerful, because when we talked to Elmer about it, he was like, yeah, we knew that we had to have this one, this one, this one, this one, and this one, and they all had to be on that same 2-page spread, and that was just amazing. There was a lot of little things that you could look for in that.
Right, that's the one, yes.
So we're talking about, you have all three Voltrons there.
Right.
Did you think you were just going to have like all the Voltron fans just going berserk over that?
Well, that was the plan. That was the plan. I mean, I would have liked to have had Vehicle Voltron show up and actively participate in the final battle, but again, there just wasn't room.
Right.
But
right. And then up here we've got Lotor and his mother.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we have all the Lions.
Yes, and some of the that's Rick Hunter's fan jet and the restored biplane that Roy Fokker flew for a while.
Okay, and down here we have.
Okay, that's Chiron. One of the Zentradi leaders with Lotor.
Mm-hmm.
What's significant really about that panel, and because it's only one panel, we probably weren't able to make it clear, is this that Zentradi are 10 times bigger than humans.
Right.
So at this point, giants. Lotor is Chiron's scale. He's been through the process that he's been increased in size.
Okay.
Like I said, that's not entirely clear, but that's right. that was what we were trying to say.
Okay. All right. And then down here we have
Min-May and Allura.
Okay. And then the rest of the Voltron force.
Right, right.
And that's... isn't that Max?
I think, yeah, that's okay. Max. Okay.
And then over here we have is it a Robeast?
Yeah, that's Brita. He's another Zentradi. He starts off as a villain, but eventually changes sides and becomes a good guy. And we wanted to do him going toe-to-toe with a Robeast kind of Ultraman style.
That would be cool. That would have been really cool. And then over here is the SDF one?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right, well, that's all happening during this executing the hyperspace fold jump.
Yeah. Oh, and another thing, from issue 4, Tommy let me work up, the couple of scenes where I spend a little more time with Claudia Grant, dealing with her stress and having her have kind of an extreme reaction to what Rick Hunter tried to do, I thought would be good for a couple of reasons. One, it was just a little more emotional intensity. It set things up at the end when Alfor offers him the white lion. He was at a place where he was going, I can't do anything. I'm a kid, and I'm not doing that well over here.
Right. You know? I don't want to screw up again.
Yeah, yeah, right? It kind of put him in a good, kind of an interesting place to win it.
Okay.
So that's a couple of things I can tell you about.
Yeah, he was probably pretty confused at that point, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so. Some of these subplots were, you know, for the Voltron fans, they're not as familiar with the Robotech characters and everything, but there are some Voltron fans that are fans of both.
Right.
What are some of the subplots that were in this that might be confusing to a Voltron fan? Like, we had talked about this is a crossover, you know, a lot of things can happen. We're talking about the Omega Comet and the time-space continuum, and we get to see the fathers of Roy and Rick,
right,
and they're working together in Iraq during the Desert Storm, and during that, one of them dies, Roy's father.
Yeah,
Roy's father dies, and so there was the understanding that if one of them died, that he would take care of the other person's son.
Right. Yeah. Well. Okay. Let's talk about that for a second. The Robotech series proper begins with the idea that Rick Hunter arrives on Macross Island to see the launching of the SDF-1.
Mm-hmm.
Roy has been there for a couple of years now as a test pilot and doing various test pilot things on the island. But they used to be doing an air show together, the Pop Hunters air show.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were pretty close until Roy left to go back to Macross Island, and
right.
That's where that whole relationship comes from. There, I guess now that I think about it, we don't see them interact all that much. But you know, Roy and Claudia were also very close. One of the comics I wrote is called "The Return to Macross," and what that is set in the 4 or 5 years before the Zentradi arrive. So I've written about Roy and Claudia's relationship a little bit. Again, we probably didn't have the space to develop it as well as it might not have been entirely clear.
So by having this happen during the Voltron crossover, all right, you were able to get Rick Hunter and Roy Fokker and Claudia and Min May. And did we also get Lisa or not?
Yeah, Lisa's seen from time to time on the bridge crew.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Tommy had mentioned that. All right, and then we also on the Voltron side we get Sven,
right,
which everybody was happy to see, you know, because we weren't sure if we were going to get Sven, but like you said, we weren't able to bring the vehicle Voltron crew into it. If there was an additional miniseries, or if this had been extended out to like 12 issues, you probably would have wanted to bring both.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Gosh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm actually a little more of a vehicle Voltron fan than the Lion Force.
Okay, that's
you
good.
Know, you know, there has to be, there's always one, right?
Right, well,
but
they're few and far between, but we know about pretty much all of them.
I bet you do. So, yeah, I was interested in trying to get both Voltrons on stage, like they did in the Devil's Do. I forget what they were called.
Yeah, Devil's Do Publishing.
Yeah,
with Dan Jolly.
Yeah, right. That's the one. Yeah,
right. And then also there was the TV special that they did. That was actually a movie. So it was called
The Fleet of Doom.
Fleet of Doom.
I actually only just watched that.
Oh, you did? Since
you and I talked. We just got our Hulu membership. So yeah,
Yeah. So it's out there on Hulu.
Yeah.
Okay. So what did you think of Fleet of Doom?
It was good. Hagar's origin Hagar's origin was interesting, and certainly,
right.
And it was certainly nice to see both teams working together. That I had picked up from somewhere that Pidge had a brother on the Vehicle Force team, but sure. Beyond that, I didn't know much about that one way or the other.
Right. Right. As far as a lot of people's memories of Vehicle Voltron versus Lion Voltron. Yeah. Was that there was almost like a similar type of character on Vehicle Voltron as there was on...
Right.
You would find another Keith, you would find another Pidge, you would find another Hunk, on the Vehicle team. And the thing about it was there was 15 pilots over there, so not all of them could have the same attributes as the Line Force pilots.
And there were some extraterrestrials on the Vehicle team, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. With the Vehicle Voltron that came in Fleet of Doom, there's still a lot of people that would have liked to have seen more of Vehicle Voltron in that one.
Oh, sure.
Because they didn't get to interact as much as they thought they could have. And, once again it's only like an hour-long show. So it's hard to get everything you want into one thing.
Oh, boy. Yeah,
I'm sure that they were, going over that. How do we get them in together? How do we get them to interact? How do we get them to, win the day together, all that kind of stuff. And it was just, there probably should have been more, but they couldn't work it in.
Right. Oh, sure.
But, with the stuff, do you have like a favorite pilot on the Voltron side?
Well, I enjoyed writing Keith a lot in the comic. Let's say that. Yeah, because he was in an interesting position, trying to sort out who he could trust and keep the team together and trying to figure out if there was a way out of all this,
Here you go. You wake up from a coma and it's almost like you're being treated as a spy.
Right.
How do you react to that?
Exactly.
And then when he meets his friends finally, he's like, all right, what is going on? And then Pidge gives him, what his version of it is.
Right.
And Pidge is pretty close to correct, right?
Right, yeah.
So when we go through the time where we're talking about Alfor,
mm-hmm.
he is in his throne room, and he's having that meeting with the people from the Planet Doom. I guess it's at the same time that the Omega Comet is coming nearby. And he plans this all so that it happens really at that time. And then when Urak summons Hagar,
right.
And Hagar comes in, and immediately Alfor grabs the keys off of her neck, off of her necklace. You see her almost, at the beginning of her coming into the scene, she looks like her younger self, her younger, more beautiful self. And it's because, like Tommy was saying, that she was able to, give herself the illusion of what she used to look like.
Mm.
And then it so quickly happened that she turned old again. And then she just said, damn you, and slashed Urak, and that's how his eye got the way it did. And why he needed the patch.
Right.
So that was a pretty good backstory that we had never seen for your ex patch.
Right. Yeah. That's Tommy's work, and it was a very good scene.
Now, did you get to implement anything that was like a backstory on either side, the Robotech side or the Voltron side, where nobody had ever seen that before?
No, not so much in this series. I mean, I've done backstories in the other comics I've written, but not so much in Robotech Voltron.
Okay, was there any reference to something you had done previously in any of your previous work?
Yes, one of the things I did in this first series I did for Eternity called the Malcontent Uprisings. Like I say, they were the opposition, let's not call them the villains, was the was the remaining Zentradi on Earth. And as I put the story together, I realized I would probably need some Zentradi vocabulary. And a little bit of the Zentradi vocabulary is used in that scene at the end of issue two, that there's a phrase, Karat Sul, I think it is. And
oh, yeah, I wondered what that meant. What does that mean?
It translates roughly as, I will serve and die for you.
Okay. What made you decide to use that?
Well, it's a way of Zentradi saying that I'm acknowledging your orders and I'm going to do it.
Okay.
I had a fairly decent vocabulary list put together, which I was able to use in some of the other comics, and Jim Lucino used a modified version of it in one of the McKinney, one of the later McKinney original novels, a thing called the Zentradi Rebellion. So, yeah, I was able to put together at least the start of a Zentradi vocabulary and grammar. Yeah.
Have you read the McKinney novels?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All of them?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Wow.
Well, I'll tell you how it worked, how this worked out. When I was plotting Malkinton Uprisings, mm-hmm. Robotech was actually off the air. So what I had was the comics, the paperbacks, and Robotech Art 1. Mm-hmm. So I had already been buying the paperbacks because I would go back to them for reference. And as things wore on, and Del Rey decided they wanted to do some original novels, they decided they were going to do a novel about this period called the Malkinton Uprisings. And Jim Lucino, a gentleman and a scholar, was aware of my comics, and he called Eternity, I guess, and got my number. So I just got a call from him one day.
Wow.
And he introduced himself, and he wanted to see my Zentradi vocabulary list. He wanted to run some things past me from time to time about mm-hmm. how he was doing this. We've been friends ever since. So I'm acknowledged on the front page of the Zentradi Rebellion, in the front page of one of the later original books. And one of the later original books is dedicated to me. So, yeah. So we've been friends for a good long time now.
Good. What's he like?
Great individual. Great individual. A great plotter, a great storyteller. He's always, been very supportive of the stuff I've been doing. He and I tend to plot in the same ways, have the same interest in plotting. And we both have the same interest in continuity and, maintaining the canon.
Okay, so there's been so many different versions of Robotech with the Macross saga,
right?
The Sentinels,
right?
The Invids,
right?
And what am I missing?
The middle third would be the Robotech Masters.
Oh, the Robotech Masters.
Yeah.
Southern Cross isn't worked out.
Southern Cross is the Robotech Masters.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, is there a canon that goes through all of those, or how does that work?
Yeah, there is a canon that goes through all of those. I mean, there are some things that don't quite match up because they were, after all, originally three different series. Mm-hmm. but we've gotten a lot of them. We've gotten a lot of them to match up.
Okay. Well, you've heard recently that Sony Pictures picked up the rights to do the Robotech live action movie.
Yeah.
All right. Where do you think they should start, and what path should they take?
Okay. Well, if I
if you were involved in
my fantasy is this: the first original Robotech comic actually was a graphic novel that Kyle Machek did, which showed how the SDF-1 was stolen by a character called Zor from the Southern Cross sequence, okay. And how it arrives on Earth, and how eventually Retai is sent out to go get the SDF-1.
Okay.
What I would recommend would be to kind of do what they did in Lord of the Rings. The first movie would start with 15, 20 minutes of Zor and Britai and the SDF-1, so that you could introduce the Invid and these other characters, and then have the have the SDF one land on Earth. And the first movie, there's a break around episode 12 or 13, which would be a really good break for the first movie. And
okay.
That would be what I would do, is combine some stuff from the graphic novel and a condensed version of, say, maybe the first 13 episodes.
Okay, and then if there was the opportunity to do more movies, like a trilogy at least?
Yeah. I would say go ahead and try and do it. Go ahead and try and do it, you know, more or less linearly, the way it was presented originally.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that was one of the big charms, is that when Robotech came on, it was a generation story. You know, generation stories in science fiction prose are, you know, they happen. But when Robotech arrived, the only other generation story in visual science fiction that I'm aware of was Planet of the Apes. I mean, we hadn't seen Star Trek Next Generation yet, and none of that was going on yet.
Right. But we had seen, what, four or five?
Yeah, five of the original Planet of the Apes movies.
Planet of the Apes, yeah. All right.
Yeah. So, I don't think this is going to happen, and I'm not sure it's a good idea if they did, but all this talk about cinematic universes, I was fantasizing the other day that I could almost see Sony announcing that they were going to do one Macross movie, one Southern Cross movie, and one Invid movie, and go back and forth between them.
But, oh, wow. You mean like sort of the way that Marvel has done with each of their individual Avengers movies,
right,
and then the whole Avengers?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't think it should. But
right. Well, there's a lot of people out there who are... As soon as that story came out, a lot of people started speculating, and a lot of people started saying, well, this is what I would want to have. And, you know, they all have a different opinion, it seems. How do you satisfy all the people? You can't, really.
I don't know. I mean, maybe you can only settle for them being equally dissatisfied. like I said, I did a lot of work on newspapers, and I was never, you know, a hard-nosed reporter or anything, but sometimes you just had to go, well, both sides are upset with me, I must be doing my job, you know.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, on the Voltron side, obviously it's always been, you know, between Line Force Voltron and Vehicle Voltron, they're both Voltron,
right?
Okay. And they both had their own set of episodes, and they were both good in their own rights. You know, one was, it was based on going against Zarkon and the Drill forces, whereas in Vehicle Voltron, it was always more, they were true space explorers because they were looking to, you know, find another planet that matched their own planet.
Right, that's my understanding.
And it was sort of the same thing that was happening with the Drool community. They were out there looking, and they just sort of hit heads with each other, and no one really understood each other very well. There was really not a true bad guy, you know, like there was with Zarkon.
Right.
So, and in a way, it was more closer to what Robotech was than Lion Force Voltron was. So it would have been probably, a lot of people probably would be saying, why didn't they have the Vehicle Voltron team? Because they had one ship.
Right.
With one giant robot. And it would have matched up perfectly with SDF-1. The Zentradi thought that they were in the right to do what they were doing. And, you know, the Drools thought they were within their right to do what they were doing. You know?
Yeah, I think that's probably, yeah, I think that's probably one of the reasons why, like I say, I personally like the Vehicle Voltron a little better, but certainly, you know, I understand why the Lion Voltron is the more popular. I mean,
yeah, it just seems like they line up closer than the Lion Force the same set of characters from Robotech. So I would have liked to have seen a Vehicle Voltron version of that crossover, but we're never going to get that.
No, I don't imagine. I don't imagine. As far as Voltron goes, you know, I watched Voltron regularly, but, you know, I haven't seen all the episodes, and I haven't, you know, kind of lived with them the way I've lived with the Robotech characters. So
you've really lived with the Robotech characters, haven't you?
Sort of, yeah.
Do you ever have, like, dreams about them?
Once in a great while.
Yeah.
Once in a great while. I've had one or two fighting robot dreams. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to do when I got the assignment was to, you know, I went back and I looked at the Omega Comet episodes and a couple of episodes in general just to try and get the speech patterns and the attitudes of the characters right. Hopefully I managed, you know.
Now, did you watch it the same way Tommy did? He said he watched the Go Lion episodes and not the Voltron, the Americanized version.
I watched Voltron.
Okay.
I watched Voltron. I may have seen a couple of scenes of Go Lion on YouTube, but mm-hmm. ultimately I was relying more on Voltron. Yeah.
Have you ever seen the Go Lion where they go through, you know, everything is unedited, you know, not Americanized and everything, and the actual violence that they had in there?
Oh, I like I say, I think I just saw clips on YouTube, and I can't say I remember anything about
there's
the violence.
Some pretty gruesome stuff, like heads being chopped off and cannibalism and all kinds of nasty stuff.
Well, that's interesting when you consider that Lion Force of Voltron was kind of marketed as an all ages property here in America.
Yeah. <That's>, yeah. But I mean, I'm sure when Peter Keefe was bringing two or three Japanese properties together to make Voltron, and they were going to make it a trilogy, and then at the same time Carl Masek is bringing together other Japanese properties to build Robotech. I'm sure there was a lot of, you know, people who told these guys at the time, it's not going to work. There's no way you can make this into something that works for television audiences, for children, you know, watching cartoons in the United States. So it's pretty big accomplishment.
It is. You're probably aware of this. I mean, one of the things that applies to both Voltron and Robotech is there was almost no home video market at the time.
Right.
So what they were doing was trying to create a package that could be syndicated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason why they went to the idea of connecting series that may not have obvious connections or any real connections.
Right. So the idea was that, you know, you could market this across, you know, at least two thirds of the United States, you know, hit the major advertisers, and then you'd be able to have all kinds of money rolling in.
Right. Right.
But it was the toy market that really took off for these guys, right?
Yep.
Do you have any Robotech toys?
Oh, sure. I managed to get a lot of the original line of action figures from Matchbox during the when I started to work on the characters. Although at that point, a lot of that stuff was like in the remainder bins at Toys R Us, because Robotech wasn't quite as popular as the Matchbox was hoping to be, and a lot of that stuff was already being put into clearance bins and stuff. But so I was able to pick up a lot of different things that way. We even found a Lin Min Mei fashion doll, a Barbie sized fashion doll that Matchbox marketed. Much later, there was, I forget exactly when it was, sometime in the 90s, there was a syndicated animated show called Exo Squad.
Mm-hmm.
That was a science fiction show that had a lot of mecha elements. Harmony Gold arranged to have a lot of the Robotech mecha remarketed as part of the Exo Squad line. And they put together a package of different mechas. So, I mean, I got a lot of the figurines from the original Matchbox, but a lot of the bigger mecha I didn't get until they came out as part of the Exo Squad line. But by this point, I was writing comics regularly, talking about crossovers. When I saw this stuff coming up under the Exo Squad logo, my thought was, okay, someone's going to pitch an Exo Squad Robotech crossover. Can I get to it first? So I plotted one and sent it to the company that had the license at that point, and it never got anywhere. And it's probably just as well. But in terms of an unusual crossovers, I can tell you the ideas go back at least that far.
Wow, that's pretty far. I know Tommy had said that they had a lot of people approaching them about crossovers.
Right.
Do you think this was the perfect one?
Yeah, I do. I do. Okay, I think
and did you get really excited when he said that he'd like you to participate?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So what was that first meeting like?
Officially, I was offered the spot at the New York Comic Con in 2013.
I was there.
Yeah. Okay.
So you were there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Tommy had asked me to come up, and you know, he wanted to talk to me about something, and that's about really most of what I knew at that point. I mean, I knew that the crossover was coming, but that's all I knew about it. And
right.
But he wanted me to come up, and he offered it to me then, and you know, introduced me to some of the folks at Dynamite, so they knew who I was, and that's when it first that's when I was officially added to the project. Yeah.
So you got to meet Nick Ferrucci.
Yeah, and Joe Rybant, I think his name is. Mm-hmm. That's who I met. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So they're talking about making a trade paperback now, 5 issues together in one. And that should be coming out later this year. Are you going to have any input in that? Or is that just something that they do? And I know Tommy was talking about adding some things to it.
Nothing is planned at this point that I would... I don't think I'm going to be having any direct input in it, but things could change. I mean, nearly everything that comes out in monthly issues now is put into trade paperback form eventually.
Right.
But I didn't know that the trade paperback had actually been finally scheduled, or even this far along. So,
well, when the issues come out, or when a trade paperback comes out, do they ask the writers and the artists and stuff like that to maybe like go to the conventions or anything?
Oh, sure.
Sign.
Yeah,
copies of them.
Yeah, I do that, and you know, in some cases, you might be asked to do an introduction or some sort of behind the scenes article. Oh yeah, absolutely.
So you've been to several of these types of things then, comic book conventions?
Oh, yeah.
Thing.
Yeah.
All right. What's some of the things that you remember the most?
Well, there's different ways to answer that. I was at the 10th anniversary Robotech convention in California, 20 years ago.
1995.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually that was in Anaheim.
Come to think of it.
Now that I think about it, and the chance to talk to Robotech fans, in a sort of dedicated environment where you can talk about Robotech was big fun.
Wow!
And sometimes at cons, it's the little incidents that stick with you in the long run. I mean, at the very beginning of my career, before Robotech, actually, I was at a con in New Jersey, and this one kid. 5, 6, 7 years old, a little boy came over and talked to me a little bit beginning of the day, and then he left to do other stuff. But at the end of the day, he came over and told me, you know, very seriously, very sincerely, you know, don't feel bad if a lot of people didn't talk to you, they just don't know you yet, you know.
Wow.
You know.
That's you know? Pretty prophetic for a yeah. little kid.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Wow. And you know, and pretty empathic.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's pretty cool.
It is.
And did anybody have a conversation with you about Robotech things at any of these conventions that just has stayed with you all this time?
Not in-depth conversations,
no.
But I had a brief conversation with the gentleman who provided Roy Foker's voice in the cartoon. So that was at the 10th anniversary convention. So that was one thing that stayed with me. And sometimes too, you will talk to somebody and then discover much later that you meet again in another format. When I started. My Facebook account, which was, gosh, 5 years ago already. One of the first people who friended me was a guy named Daniel Coyle, who it turns out I'd been talking to on and off at cons before that, and I just didn't have a face or a name to go with it.
Right. You know? So he struck out conversations with you on Facebook.
Then. Yeah, yeah.
All right, so you have some fans that are following you on Facebook.
Then. Yes. Yeah, I've had some good luck in that area. There's a couple of Robotech fans who have been very much proponents of my work. A guy named Bryant Shu and a guy who I'm not sure what his full name is, to be honest with you, but his screen name is John Thomas.
Okay.
And he's been very supportive. And I've met several fans from Venezuela. Robotech was big in Venezuela.
I found out that Voltron was pretty big in the Philippines and Australia, and we have a lot of fans from over there.
Yeah, actually, Robotech was received pretty well in Australia, too. I don't know about the Philippines one way or another, but I've talked to, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So have you, all right, have you met some international fans then?
Yeah, not face-to-face, but, not face-to-face. But on Facebook, yeah.
Okay, so at any of these conventions, did they ever ask you to sign something with a phrase or a moniker that you had written in any of the comic books?
I don't think that specifically, but I can tell you this. Like I was telling you, I was developing this Zentradi vocabulary for Malcontent Uprisings, and the letters that we were getting on Malcontents, they were incorporating the vocabulary in the letters. They were giving it back to me already.
And
that's a rush. That's a rush.
Wow, that means they've studied your stuff so completely.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's got to feel pretty good as a writer,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, it does.
It's almost like a singer or a songwriter when the fans sing the song back to you when you're singing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, one story I did want to tell you about the dialogue in Robotech Voltron.
Yeah.
You were talking about the long scene in issue 3 where they were explaining everything.
Mm-hmm. Which scene was that?
The one where Keith is reunited with the rest of his crew.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I wanted to mention this to you because it's kind of I thought it was kind of an amusing story about what happens when you're working with licensed property.
Okay.
There's this one exchange here where he says, how can the comet exist in both in the past and the present? What I had originally written for Pidge's reply was, quantum mechanics makes my head hurt. I wrote that with the idea that most of the people who knew who Pidge was would you know, understand that if this made Pidge's head hurt, it had to be pretty arcane stuff.
Right.
But when World Events went through the manuscript, they didn't like the idea that Pidge didn't know. So they created this line here.
Yeah, but you got to understand, there's been several times in either the original Voltron, Voltron the Third Dimension, or Voltron Force, where Pidge is like, I got nothing.
Well, see, that's...
I have no idea what's going on right now.
Mind you, I'm not... I want to make this clear.
Yeah.
I'm not criticizing World Events when I say this. This is just the sort of thing that happens when you've got a lot of people who have to clear
the... They want to protect the characters and their
clear the script, yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. It occurred to me afterwards, that if I had written... quantum mechanics makes even my head hurt. They might have bought it. And, I was one word away and we could have both won.
It could have been that close, probably.
Yeah. And like I say, I'm not criticizing them. I mean, this is the way things work. I just thought it was a funny story about, the communication on it.
Right. That's pretty cool. I like that. Yeah, I remember, because Dan Jolly, who's a comic book writer, did the Devils Do Publishing stuff. He had told me that when he was writing, they pretty much gave him free rein, and they said that there wasn't hardly anything that he had to change.
Okay.
And at the time, he was basically rewriting the story of the origin and made Alora into a much tougher character than had originally been done in the series. So he was kind of surprised that they were allowing him as much free rein as he was getting.
Right.
So, things have changed a little bit, probably. I guess it depends, in which direction. You don't know which direction Voltron is going. You don't know which direction Robotech's going, really.
Right.
When you're coming in as the writer, you just got to go based on what you already know and what you think you would like these characters to do.
Right, exactly.
If you were in a position where you could write some new stuff for Robotech, and the only way you were going to get the funding for it was as a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo or something like that, How would you like pitch it to the fans?
I'd like to think that one of the reasons why the fans like my Robotech stuff is that I always wrote them as fully realized characters. Just because they started in animation, I wasn't writing them as, you know, single note characters or one joke characters. I was writing them like they were on Star Trek or Babylon 5 or whatever. So my main pitch, I guess, for a Kickstarter would be that, you know, that I would keep the keep up with that level of characterization and the level of world building. You know, one of the things that I liked about, you know, going into the period before the SDF-1 arrived is because that first contact scenario was a very classic science fiction trope, and you can do all sorts of things with it. You know, one of the things I had was a group of religious fanatics on the island who thought the arrival of the SDF-1 meant doomsday was coming, and they weren't wrong, but that's reacted to it wasn't put them at odds with the Robotech Defense Force, you know. But that's a classic trope, and, you know, like Tommy said in the you know, Robotech is kind of harder science fiction, and I would like to, you know, and I would try to keep with that tone.
Yeah, so the whole concept of protoculture, what does that really encompass? I mean, what does it mean to be able to take that technology and actually do something with it?
Okay, well, there's room for interpretation in here. Kind of like when somebody's asking, well, what is actually the Force? What can you do
right,
with it?
Right, exactly. That's, what is the essence of the Force?
Yeah. It's a power source, as I understood it. You have to have protoculture in order to have transforming mecha. You can have other types of mecha and vehicles, but in order to be transforming vehicles, that you need protoculture for that. And in the novels, protoculture comes from a thing called the Flower of Life, which becomes a big element of the third part of Robotech. And Jim Lucino and Brian Daley took that even farther. People in the Robotech Masters who sensed a kind of intelligence in the Flower of Life that you could tap into and use, or sometimes vice versa, that the intelligence was using humans to do things. Sometimes I just tell people it's the local equivalent of dilithium, and it is that, but it's also more.
Well, I mean, Voltron has a similar thing. There's an energy that Voltron has that nobody understands.
Yeah.
It's a magical style of energy that somehow he's able to, you know, produce this blazing sword
right
out of nowhere. And all these weapons and stuff like that. And nobody really understands where it comes from. And there were, you know, multiple series that have been done, and they've never really gotten to the origin of it all. And we would hope someday, somehow, we would eventually get that story,
right?
that makes it all happen. But it's like you said, trying to go back and discover the origin of the Force or things like that. It's one of those things that it's a basic idea within a story that has a very deeper meaning that maybe nobody will ever understand. It's very spiritual,
right? Yeah,
yeah. It's interesting.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. As I understand it, this may not be right, but my understanding, the word protoculture was actually coined in Macross as a reference to some elder race. It was a proto-culture, and it was Karl Machek and his writers that turned it into what we know in Robotech.
So we don't know what the original Japanese interpretation was on that, or do we?
I'm pretty sure that's what it was, but, you know, I'm erring on the side of caution here.
Okay.
If you put it on a program, someone will correct me if I'm wrong. That's for sure.
So, when you first started writing with Robotech, how long did it take you to wrap your mind around all this?
Any day now.
You haven't done it yet.
Yeah. But that's the charm, both of Robotech and Voltron and the Forces, that there's always room to grow, there's always room to tip it over on its side and look at it from a new angle, you know.
Right.
Malcontent Uprisings was 12 issues. I felt pretty confident by the end of the 12 issues that, you know, I could maneuver around the universe pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but yeah, you're always learning new stuff. And part of the fun, too, with Robotech is that there's just so many characters. You don't have, you can start in with a whole new character and learn more about them and even add original characters once in a while.
Have you added new characters?
Yeah, one or two in particular. I created a character called Terry Weston, who was in a comic called Cyber Pirates, and then briefly appeared in the first issue of a comic called Invid War. I thought I had pretty much finished with him, but Jim took him and used him for three of his original novels. So it's like,
that's great.
Cool.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That would be like, I know one of the writers for Star Wars after the Return of the Jedi was finished, Timothy Zahn.
Right.
Had written characters like Grand Admiral Thrawn and Mara Jade, and other people took those characters and used them in their novels and stuff right. like that. I mean, that's got to be a pretty good feeling, too, as a writer.
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. Well, Jim Lucina was one of the main plotters of the New Jedi Order sequence. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he wrote three or four novels, but he was always involved with the plotting and keeping the continuity straight from book to book. And, you know, that's such a huge project and all. So, wow. So, I mean, he was involved with the creation of the Yuuzhan Vong, and the Yuuzhan Vong went into the comics, and I even have a Yuuzhan Vong action figure somewhere.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
All right, well, we need to wrap it up here, but I wanted to thank you for coming on the Let's Voltron podcast.
Oh, thank you for asking.
Is there something that you're working on right now, or something that we might be able to see in the near future?
I'm working on a couple of new comic proposals. I think I probably better leave it at that.
Okay.
And like I mentioned earlier, the Time Machine reprint just came out.
Right.
Yeah.
So H.G. Wells' The Time Machine reprint. Is that the name of it too?
Yeah, it's the time. Yeah, it's the Time Machine. It's available through Amazon, and it's available at the website for this Pulp 2.0 press. I should probably mention it that it's www.pulp.com. Numeral 2 OH Press.
Okay. All right. I'm glad we got that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for joining me here live in the studio. You were the first person ever who's been live in the studio with me. How does that make you feel?
I'm flattered. Flattered and touched.
So thank you very much, and we'll see you all next time on
Let's Voltron.